My name is Beatrice and I want to be an engineer.
Sometimes we use these really long phrases or complicated phrases in engineering to sound as though we're much cleverer than we are. It can be problematic because people think that it's less accessible. You know what, I think that one crossed the line, and discuss it. That's really good. And that's, I think, the sign of a really good team, that you can have that conversation and no one feels like they can't speak up if they think that a line potentially has been crossed, or even if you want to discuss whether or not the line has been crossed, you know, like, oh, are we sure about that one? Are we allowed to say that?
This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 119 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. With the upcoming Women in Engineering Day on June the 23rd, we're absolutely delighted to welcome Cathy Morton to the show. Cathy's a Royal Air Force officer with a master's degree in aeronautical engineering. Cathy, welcome to Extended.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us, Cathy. I know you're really busy. It's a busy time. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, where you're based and that sort of thing, just as an intro?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you rightly said, I'm an Air Force officer. I'm an engineer officer. Currently, I work in the Chinook delivery team, which is based at MOD Abbey Wood in Bristol. Prior to that, I did 2 years on 70 Squadron, which operates A400M out of RAF Bryce Norton. I was the junior engineering officer on the squadron when we went into initial operating capability with A400. So I had a good 2 years there.
I'd love to come back and ask you a bit about the A400. Let's come back to the Chinook team and the work you do with engineering and, of course, helicopters. What does your role actually cover?
So the delivery team isn't there to physically do engineering on the aircraft. We are removed from forward operations. We're looking at long-term support for the aircraft until its out of service date in 2040. My boss's boss, as it were, he is called the Type Airworthiness Authority. So he is responsible for the continued airworthiness of the fleet. And we, within our team, I sit on the avionics desk and we look at things like trending of faults. We look at support contracts, and I look at anything from weapon systems to fire bottles on board the aircraft, anything that's a specific military add-on within the engineering elements and the avionics elements. I will monitor, and when we have issues either at RAF Odeum or RAF Benson, which are the operating centres for Chinook within the UK, or when the aircraft are deployed, as they always are with Chinook, we will be there to support them in doing fault investigation and trying to keep them operating, really.
Sorry, just asking a question then about where they're operating. Does that mean that you ever have to go away on operations with them at all?
Not in this role, no.
Right,
so
okay.
There are junior officers, my colleagues, on each of the squadrons. Recently, I think all of the junior officers on Chinook squadrons were colleagues of mine from my engineering officer course. So that was really useful. We all knew each other, so we had really good communication between the forward squadrons and between the delivery team at Abbey Wood. And they're responsible for the day-to-day management of the aircraft,
right.
So doing engineering workforce allocation to keep the aircraft flying to a maintenance program or to a flying program. We will then look at all the data that they're producing when they do that, and we'll look at the paperwork that comes through, and we're trying to look for problems before they arise, or to help them diagnose issues that they have, which are out of the ordinary.
Right. Okay. And you're a flight lieutenant.
That's right. Yes.
That's your rank. Right. Okay. Thank you. So let's go back then to where this all began. Following you on social media, I know you've got a bit of an aviation bug, but where did it come from? Where did it all start?
It'll have to be a shout out to my father, who is one of the true aviation nerds of the world, has been at the same Air Cadet Squadron for over 50 years.
Wow.
And so I grew up with that. I think one of my first words was Spitfire. Family holidays and vacations almost always seem to end up at some sort of aviation museum. and genuinely, I spent some weekends in Southampton Hall of Aviation, which is now called Solent Sky, which is the museum in Southampton, to the point where I could give tours at age 11, I think, of the museum.
Right, okay.
So the combination of the history and the technical aspects, which my father was always very interested in, I didn't really have a chance, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So digging then a bit deeper into your dad, where's your dad's interest come from then? Where did this all sort of filter through? I mean, 50 years at the same Air Cadet Squadron, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And so he would have started there at age 13, I suppose.
Right.
And has since been a member of staff, both in and out of uniform. The number of people that have gone through the squadron that he's had an influence on is huge. There's a flight lieutenant, Abby Wood, who I work with occasionally, who was a couple of years ahead of me on that squadron. So, you know, he has had the same sort of impact on her and her career development as he has had on mine.
Wow. And
there's plenty of people out there who will say, oh, yeah, I know Phil Morton because he got me into the Air Force, et cetera. a huge impact, not just on me, but on lots of people.
And let's not let go of the AvGeek interest here. You've got a real passion and a love for the Merlin, I believe.
Absolutely. There's a Merlin engine in the one of the Science Museum in London, if anyone's near there. But I will always find them whatever museum we visit. That engine was, a huge piece of history. Southampton, obviously, being the home of the Supermarine Spitfire and R.J. Mitchell.
Yeah.
So we have had a strong affiliation to the Spitfire's history. But you mentioned actually before we started recording, you had a daughter and her name is Beatrice.
That's right.
And Beatrice Schilling is a name that is like often passed over and shouldn't be. So Beatrice Schilling was a female engineer. She was born in 1909 in Hampshire and ended up working with the Royal Aircraft Establishment, had been keen on engineering from a young age, grew up playing with Meccano, was maintaining her own motorcycle by age 14.
Wow.
And her impact into the development of the Merlin engine had a huge effect on the outcome of the Battle of Britain, because the issues that they were having with zero to negative G conditions with the Merlin engine meant that the aircraft was losing performance in dogfights. And we're talking mostly about the Spitfire here.
Yeah.
And Miss Schilling came up with a solution to this, and they called it Miss Schilling's orifice. And she, you know, in a period where there were very, very few female engineers, and even more so fewer of them in design roles or in management or leadership roles, was in the Royal Aeronautical Establishment implementing this change to design, which gave Spitfires and Hurricanes that cutting edge in combat conditions, which, you know, arguably had a big difference in the outcome of the war. So
wow.
there's my plug for women in engineering from the Second World War for you, and a Beatrice that should not be forgotten about.
No, absolutely not. And I've got the Merlin book up on my bookshelf, and I need to go and reread it because I obviously missed that or didn't remember it. So thanks so much for that. That's fascinating. Cathy, let's talk about the route that you took to becoming the sort of engineer that you are. You know, passion only takes you so far, but I know from, again, from following you, you had to work quite hard and through a torturous route to get to where you are. Let's talk about how you went through the education system and developed into the position you're at.
So I suppose torturous might not be a fair assessment in that I have been really fortunate in some areas. I had a great start at school. King Edward VI School in Southampton was very scientifically based. So I had an excellent education there, and I'm really grateful to that. The route that I took from King Edward's isn't open anymore. So I did 2 years at Welbeck, which was the Defence Sixth Form College, which is closing in next month, I think. It was a route specifically designed for technical officers in all three services and the civil service. And it would take you from age 16. So you'd go and apply to your respective service at age 16 and then go to Welbeck, do your A levels and get a smattering of education in sort of field craft and military skills on the side of it, which, you know, was caught up in a combined cadet force construct. There are no more applicants to Welbeck. That decision was made by the MOD a few years ago now. And lots of people have got opinions on that, which probably wouldn't benefit us to go into. I got a lot out of Welbeck.
Yeah.
I had moved around a little bit growing up. We lived in the States for a while, but I think really my life was a little bit sheltered, and going to Welbeck really gave me a bit of breadth of meeting people from lots of different backgrounds and putting me out of my comfort zone, because I did have it kind of easy up until then. Right. So being potentially a bit introverted, being quite nerdy, and suddenly having to share a room with two people that I'd never met before, having all of my hours dictated to me rather than having a lot of leeway in what I was doing and how I was spending my time, that's a very useful thing from a military perspective, because, you know, you often don't get a say in what's going on with your life. So that and the leadership and the military skills that I wouldn't have done even in air cadets, I really benefited from. So,
How was that structured then? You talk about a military ethos. It's not a military school, though, is it? Does it have a military structure?
It is, yes. Yeah. Okay. So we wore military uniform 2 days a week.
Okay.
We went on military exercises throughout the term. I spent a week on board HMS Bristol, things like that, for training exercise. We had regular military members of staff. So there was some NCOs who were in charge of physical training. We had an RAF flight lieutenant who was the training officer, an army major who was one of the vice principals, and a naval lieutenant adjutant. So between them, they were responsible for a lot of the military activity that we carried out.
And did you choose the Royal Air Force path going into Welbeck?
Yes, yeah. So that was how you had to do the application. So I went to OASC, the Officer and Aircrew Selection Centre, at age 16. The assessment that we did was geared towards engineering. So not a competence assessment. I can't quite get the word out, but they tested you on various things. That assessment is the same assessment that they do now, but everyone who did that assessment centre with me was applying to Welbeck, so we were only judged against our peers.
Right, okay, interesting.
Which is not how a normal application for the Air Force would go, where you'd have all branches of officer applicants would go in together.
Yeah.
Aircrew selection is slightly different in that they have more aptitude testing. Aptitude testing is the phrase that I was thinking of. So we just had an engineering specific one, but the leadership tasks and the planning assessments and things like that are the same elements that anyone would do for that selection process.
And you'd come through the air cadet system. You went to Welbeck. How did you respond to that culture? Did it feel comfortable? Did it feel natural? Did you feel like that was where your passion for engineering in the military really blossomed?
I think that I had more or less decided I was going to be an engineer quite early on, and then I saw an ad for Welbeck on the television, and I was like, well, that's how I go about it.
Yeah.
And having Abby, who was a couple of years ahead of me at my air cadet squadron, take exactly the same route was really helpful to me, because I got to see someone succeed at that and base my aspirations off of that a little bit. And it's you know, a thing we say quite a lot now is that you can't be what you can't see. So just having even like local role models or people who can demonstrate what is possible is hugely beneficial. And the air cadet organization is really outstanding for that sort of thing, because people go on to do all sorts of different stuff, but the network is still there. The friends that I had in air cadets, you know, I'm still in contact with and still meet up with all the time. So that's made a huge impact on my life.
Yeah. And so what do you come out of Welbeck with?
A-levels.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So I did maths, further maths, physics, electronics, and I did AS chemistry.
Wow.
Those are the things that will set you up for a decent engineering degree. So everyone at Welbeck was going into an engineering degree of some description.
Right.
And we had a list of universities that we were, if you were going to continue on with the sponsorship scheme at university, there was a restricted list that you could apply to. Of those subjects, I can, from where I'm sitting right now, I can see my A-level electronics folder because I still use the notes.
Right. That's good education then, isn't it?
Yes, and Mr. Dufton probably won't listen to this podcast. I did write him a letter early in the year when I was dealing with a particular problem at work, and I was like, you know what, I probably ought to tell him, but I'm sat here with my AS analog systems notes.
Yeah. And I know one of the things that you do is you do use that experience. I know that you go into local schools and talk about the work you do in your career as well, don't you?
I actually love talking about my job.
Lucky because I've got you on job. Here then.
Yeah. it goes both ways. Some of the young people that I've met will come back to me, you know, months later or years later and be like, oh, you know, you came to my school and now I'm applying and doing this, and I was wondering if you could, you know, read my application, or could you recommend a reading list or something like that for a particular course or whatever. And they're actually much more forward thinking than I was at that age, because I just saw an ad on the television. I was like, right, that's the way to do it. And I just kind of stuck my head on one path and went for it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really, I had the benefit from air cadets of having done summer camps to RAF stations. So an RAF St Athan, strangely, was the one that really sold it for me, because St Athan is not a popular station anymore.
No.
But it used to be our electrical school. And I remember going around the school on a tour, and I was like, this is where I want to be doing. These are my people, as it were. So that is what really sold me on it, I suppose. But I guess I didn't really question the path that I set myself on from that point. Whereas I've got sort of the sort of 14 to 18 age group now that I speak with are much more questioning about what I do. And I think they probably have a better insight into some of the difficulties that they might face. It never really occurred to me until I got to university that actually women in engineering, it's quite a small group.
Yeah.
And I knew female engineers, and therefore I hadn't really thought it was an issue. My mother was a software engineer, and we were very technical in our family. It just didn't occur to me that was noteworthy.
Yeah.
And until I got to university and there were women in engineering groups, you know, structures and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I never really thought about it. Whereas I think now the teenagers that I talk to are more aware of that as a question. And potentially also more aware of, you know, women in the military being a smaller group as well. So I do get some interesting questions from them about what that means for me and my experiences.
Yeah, interesting.
That I wouldn't have thought of at their age at all.
Wow, okay. So tell us about uni then. You went on to university directly from Welbeck?
Yeah, I did 4 years at Loughborough. I tell people I spent 4 years playing hockey and also got a master's degree. Loughborough is a great university for sport. That's well known. And that is the reason that I went. The degree program for aeronautical engineering is also excellent. And the work that I got to do with Rolls-Royce especially was great fun. So I did my master's looking at modelling airflow inside a combustion engine and how we can produce test equipment to measure that.
Wow.
Okay. The topic is experimental fluid mechanics, which sounds a lot fancier than it was. I essentially made probes using a 3D printer and put them into a wind tunnel. But
You're quite humble, Kathy.
I think sometimes we use these really long phrases or complicated phrases in engineering to sound as though we're much cleverer than we are, and it can be problematic because people think that it's less accessible.
Yeah,
you know, if I go around talking about experimental fluids and stuff like that, people are like, what are you on about? It means that I was measuring stuff and running experiments. In the same way that experimental physics is just people carrying out experiments in the physics area. So it's not as complicated as it sounds, I promise.
And coming out of uni, were you guaranteed then a position in the Royal Air Force?
Subject to passing a medical and passing your degree, yes.
Right, okay. And what was that role and where was it?
So the engineering branch in the RAF is split into AS, Aircraft Systems, and CE, Communications Engineering. So I am in the AS stream, so yeah. I look at aircraft systems. From leaving university, I went to RAF Cranwell to do the initial officer training course, the old version as it is now, because they have updated it recently, which is the same course for any officer in the Air Force who is going into a non-specialist trade. I would argue that engineering is quite specialist, but by that I mean not lawyers, not dentists,
yeah,
not doctors or nurses who have already had to go away and do a significant amount of professional training before they join. And padres are in that list as well. So the IoT is for all of our other branches, from air crew to police officers, etc.
Right, okay.
That was 30 weeks when I did it. It's a good course. It's a great course. It's one of the best courses, arguably, in the world. You can tell that because lots of other countries will send their best and brightest officers to come to Cranwell to do that course.
Well, a bit of a challenge, Kathy. I've heard conflicting reports about that course, and that's not from any experience. We've had some, I might say, long in the tooth RAF personnel who've not necessarily been that complimentary about it. So it's really interesting to hear the positive feel and vibe. What do you think made it fit? Why do you come to that conclusion? I'm just intrigued, really.
It's not all rosy. There were bits of it that I didn't agree with at the time. And unfortunately for me, I was probably more vocal about that than I should have been on the course. But that is who I am. And in engineering, that's the kind of people that we want, arguably.
But vocal in the right way.
Yes, appropriately. Appropriate, yeah. Challenging is what we ask for in amongst our officers.
Yeah.
And so I think that the pros outweigh the cons, in that the way that the course was structured when I did it assumed no baseline knowledge of the military at all.
Right,
so
okay,
having done X number of years as a cadet, X number of years at Welbeck, and then 4 years at university where I was also a reservist on a scheme which was tri-service, which meant it was heavily army centered. That's what the word tri-service means. And that scheme was designed to prepare you for Sandhurst, and I obviously didn't go to Sandhurst. There is a lot less living in a tent from Cranwell. So those elements of it didn't faze me, really, which meant that I could focus on the things that I did find a bit more difficult, which is good, you know, and that everyone will be challenged by different things on a course like IoT.
Yeah.
And the aim at the end of it is that we produce people who we are happy to lead and to take necessary risks, which is what officers are there for, and to more importantly and most importantly, look after the people under their command.
Yeah. All right. That's a really good way of looking at it. Thanks for that. And I didn't mean to challenge you too much. I hope you don't mind, but it was quite interesting to hear your views looking back on it.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Let's talk a little bit then about moving into service. You mentioned the A400M. Was that where you went to first?
So we all have phase two training. So after IOT, I went to Cosford to do engineering officer foundation training, which again has been adapted since I did it.
Yeah.
But that was my comfort zone. I say that trying not to be particularly arrogant about it, but not everyone on my course had done an aeronautical engineering course, so there was a lot of matriculation for people who didn't have that background. And I'm actually not very good at exams, so I benefited from
now come from on
no honestly I don't do well at regurgitating knowledge, writing it down, and that's actually really common amongst engineers. And I there's a quote about
formula
fish climbing trees and things, but but the practical elements and the second term we focused on regulation and policy around military airworthiness and the difference between military airworthiness and the way that the civil side of the industry does things, which is really important that we understand that difference. The loss of the Nimrod, which led to the Haddon Cave report, which, you know, I had to get Haddon Cave in there somewhere. But the outcome of that was this phrase, civilian as possible, military as necessary. And that's kind of how I have been brought up in the Air Force. And that's not necessarily true of a lot of the people that I work with who have been in a bit longer, who while they've been taught that lesson, haven't had it as like the bedrock of their education. So some of the mentalities are still shifting because of that.
Wow. Okay.
The final bit of the course, we had a fleet of Jaguars. I think they've got Tornadoes at Cosford now to do this course. We essentially pretended to run a fast jet squadron from the engineering perspective, and everyone rotated through different jobs within the squadron, and you were assessed in that period. And so when you do that assessment, you're paired up with someone for your like official, this is your course assessment, as an engineering officer. The person that I was paired up with, Callum, we got on really well, and we just, like, the only way I can put it is that we just bossed it. Our serial of that assessment was really smooth. We'd between us kind of covered everything in our studying, so we were just quite a good pair. It is not normal to leave engineering officer foundation training and go straight onto a flying squadron. We had done station visits beforehand, so we'd done like a tour of the Air Force to learn about different squadrons, different establishments, to see that they all kind of work a little bit differently, but they're all made up of the same parts. Normally from Cosford, you go to something like be OC Arm, so in charge of an armory, or in charge of survival equipment, or in charge of ground equipment. You end up in a bay as opposed to a squadron of junior engineering officer. But we knew that there were going to be one or two who would go straight onto the squadrons, and it wasn't until I think 3 days before the end of the course that I realized, oh, actually I might be in that bracket on my course. So it was a very surreal feeling, because you do a board, so you sit in front of a wing commander and he asks you lots of questions just to make sure that he's happy, because he runs the school and he's got to sign off on the end of the day that you're fit to go out and engineer in the Air Force. And if you don't do it well, it's going to reflect poorly on him. It was a him at the time, obviously, when I say that. So I did that. And it was done in alphabetical order, and Emma's in the middle. So a couple of people had those interviews went on for a couple of days afterwards. And then on like the final week of the course, we all got marched in one by one to his office, and he would tell you whether or not you'd passed or failed and shake your hand, and then you'd march out again. And that moment of, oh, I passed EOFT now, was one of the more surreal moments of my life, because for the last 7 years, that's all I'd been trying to achieve. You know, I at age 14, I'd seen an ad on television. I was like, right, I want to be that. And the way to do it is I've got to get these A-levels and get this degree, and then I've got to pass these courses. And then I remember just being like, so what now? Because there's about a 20-minute period where they didn't, you hadn't been given your assignment yet.
Right, okay.
So, and I literally, we'd had interviews with our course officer about what your preferences would be, that they try and match you up with sort of things that you're going to be interested in, or a particular aircraft type or a station that's, you know, convenient for you geographically or whatever. And I'd kind of been pretty relaxed about it, because I was like, Marie, I just want to be done with training. I don't really mind where you send me. I don't think enough. I want to be fast jets, but apart from that, I don't really mind. When we did the station visits, when we looked at fast jets, the ones that we saw were OCUs, so squadrons.
Yeah.
And there's nothing against that at all. I just thought, like, wandering around the squadron, it didn't feel like the right place for me. And there's different cultures across the Air Force, and that impression I had at that point of, oh, I don't really want to be a fast jet Jengo, was completely, like, you know, an off-the-cuff comment. I actually wanted to be a Chinook Jengo. That was my plan. But the Air Force, it turns out, doesn't really care about your plans. And there were no jobs slots for Chinook Jengos at the time. I was expecting to go into be OC component equipment flight at Odeon, because that was coming up. And then that would have led me quite nicely into a Chinook Jengo job. My friend Katie got that job instead. And so, and she was before me on the, when they announced the appointments. So I was like, oh, okay, I haven't got that one. That's a pity.
Okay. Right.
And then, so the way they did it when I was there, they had an electronic Wheel of Fortune thing set up. So, and it was programmed. So that's not how they decided your appointment or anything like that. It was programmed, but you went up and you pushed the space bar or whatever, and it would spin round and it would land on wherever you were going. And each person had a different wheel. So I went up to the front of the room, and the squadron leader who was in charge of the course said, oh, is there anything on that wheel that you don't want to do? And I looked at it, and there was one of them that I didn't even know what it was. I do now, on air platform systems, and a couple of others. I was like, well, you know, I don't really mind any of those, so it's fine. And so I clicked the space bar, and round the pointer went, and then landed on 70 Squadron at Bryce. And I was stood there going, which one is 70 Squadron? because it was A400, and they had never had a junior engineering officer on A400 yet. I was the first one. So that's why it didn't automatically click what platform it was, because it hadn't occurred to me that they were going to let a first tourist baby flying officer be the first ever A400 Jengo.
Yeah, okay. You keep using the term Jengo. What's that mean?
Junior engineering officer.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So we officially have Jengos, junior, and Sengos, the senior. Unofficially, there are also Fengos, who are the future engineering officers who are doing the engineering course for commissioning airmen at Cosford. And there are also Bengos, who are baby engineering officers who haven't yet got to their squadrons.
Right, okay. Wow, learned something new.
Yeah, we love an acronym in the military.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. So you got to go to the A400s. Wow.
Yes, a baptism of fire. People hear that I did that as a first tourist, and they'll say, oh, you must have impressed someone on your course. And I was like, no, either I really impressed them or I really upset them, and I've never really figured out which.
Was it a challenging aircraft?
Yes. A challenging job, a challenging environment, and a challenging aircraft. So being the way that A400 has been set up within the military is unique, in that we have contracted the operation of the aircraft from a maintenance perspective to Airbus. So rather than working specifically to the RAF's engineering policies, we got to write our own. That's the simplest way of putting it. I could talk to you about the 4000 series of the MAA regulations and things like that, because sadly I know them really well now because I had to in that job. So it was interesting from that perspective. That also meant that my line technicians I was managing, 30% of them were civilians.
Okay.
Which, from my perspective, is probably the biggest opportunity that A400 has, because I was talking about how there are people in the Air Force who didn't grow up post Haddon Cave and didn't get fed continuing airworthiness, civilian as possible, military as necessary, as they were being educated as engineers. And there is sometimes an element of, we do it like this because this is the way we've always done it in the military.
Yeah, sure.
A400 doesn't have that because it had camo from day one. It had a camo built around a civilian construct from day one. And the breadth of experience amongst the technicians, because there wasn't a lot of experience for the platform because it was brand new. So the breadth of experience amongst the technicians. Clive Jennings, who had been in the Air Force for, since Canberras were a thing, left and then went to work for Virgin and now was working for Airbus and had come back as a civilian maintainer, through to guys who had been in the Air Force their entire careers. My Airbus oppo Adam had never been in the military, but he had worked for like every airline that I'd never heard of, in some really bizarre places as well, like lived in Singapore working on airlines out there. So, and he had no concept of the military at all when he got into that job, whereas I had from age 14 I had gone, I'm going to be an Air Force engineer officer. So,
yeah. Wow.
And I'd got so nerdy about engineering policy on my course. So whenever new issues come up, I could sit there with Adam and be like, well, this is the Air Force's answer to this problem, but we have the opportunity on A400 to do it differently because we're not as tied into the policy. The same regulation applies, but the way that you interpret it, the way that you comply with it can be different. And Adam would come with his, well, in KLM we did this, and when I was working in Alaska we did these things, and we could come up with a solution that worked for us in our environment. That is engineering. That is problem solving using everything that you've got to cover for the fact that we had a brand new aircraft that was problematic. I'm going to put it out there. A400.
It had its problems, didn't it?
And I've got some beautiful pictures, beautiful might not be the right word, of the inside of some of those gearboxes and things like that, and all the other things that we had. And it's a new aircraft. We talk about the reliability bathtub curve. Is it going to be difficult while you work out some of the kinks and you build reliability data so that you can do your reliability-centered maintenance analysis and all of that? And then you get a plateau of good service life, and then you get to the end of it and it starts falling off again. So that bathtub curve, we were absolutely in the first bit of it. And it was awesome, because the people that I worked with were fantastic, and really willing to come up with solutions. So they got me through what could have been two really difficult years. And to be fair, by the end of it, I was exhausted.
I can imagine. And also the A400, I would imagine, and again, was one of those data-driven solutions where there was lots of data coming out of systems and engineering models and things like that. How did you go about then understanding what the sort of predictive nature of some of the maintenance and some of the interventions might need to be?
So I'm going to say that we didn't get there while I was there. You need quite a lot of data to produce models like that. And predictive maintenance is absolutely a thing in civilian flying, where you are, particularly airliners, where you're flying, as much as you can out of those airframes, and you're doing very similar sortie profiles consistently. So you have a lot of data being generated.
Yeah.
We don't fly with that consistency in the military. We fly different sortie profiles, we fly training profiles. A400 did things like low level loops, doing contour flying, and we did search and rescue training, and we ended up in the Falklands doing maritime patrol and stuff like that. All of those are producing different sets of data.
Yeah.
And it's all good stuff, but have not, in the military, we haven't got to the point that civilian industry has of how to use that data to the greatest effect that we can. In civil aviation, that data is your profit margin.
Yeah.
You know, and an aircraft that's on the ground is losing money, and that's how, so the impetus to exploit that data as much as possible is to do with profit. We don't have that driver in the military, and the way that we gather our data is limited because we fly differently and arguably fly less. You know, military aircraft spends more time on the ground than a civilian one does. If you look at some of the issues that Voyager has had in service, some of that is purely because it flies less than a normal A330. Caterpillars and pitot probes.
Wow.
that was a great day.
I get where you're coming from.
Technical data exploitation is an area that the MAA and defence need to expand into, and we are doing it, but there is a lot to be learned, I think, from what the Sweden industry has accomplished in that area.
Fascinating. So you did, having been put through the mill on the A400 at 70 Squadron, you now are working with your beloved Chinook?
Yes, the Walker. And Chinook is, you know, potentially at the other end of that bathtub curve. So a lot of the issues I deal with on a day-to-day basis are obsolescence driven. So I've gone from the extreme end to the other. We're not getting rid of Chinook anytime soon. From a comparative stance, the out of service date is still 2040. Although we are looking, it's been announced in the integrated review, we are looking at which airframes we will retire in the next few years as the new tranche comes in. But you know, the upgrades that have gone on from Mark 1 to now we have, you know, Mark 5s, Mark 6, Mark 6A, the upgrades have meant that there's some interesting config stuff with some systems, and with other systems we are looking at obsolescence when it comes to contracts with particular providers and things like that for some of our systems. So from an avionics perspective and from a military systems perspective, that is my biggest project that I'm working on now is purely obsolescence driven.
One question, Kathy, I forgot to ask you. Is there any impact? Is there any thing that you have to go through going from fixed wing to rotary?
So the engineering principles are all the same. Each platform that you work on, you will go and do a specific course. So the A400 course was 2 weeks. When I rang my first boss to, you know, introduce myself and say, oh, you know, I've just been told I'm posted to your unit. And he told me that the course would be in Seville. And then I got to Brise and they'd set it up to run it at Brise in Oxfordshire instead. So I've never quite forgiven Rob for that.
No, I'm sure you haven't.
The Chinook course is run at RAF Odium. The Chinook maintenance school at Odium is really good, and they've got some excellent training aids down there as well. The DFR, the familiarization rig that we use to show the maintainers how the digital aircraft flight control system works, is really cool. You can see the control rods moving with pilot input from like a Microsoft Flight Sim style simulator. So that's quite good. And it's nice to see that stuff in action, because that is one of the newer upgrades, which has only just finished, actually. It's only just been rolled out across the fleet, DAFIX.
What does a normal day look like then for you, Kathy?
So right now, COVID means I'm working from home because I can, you know, there are obviously pros and cons to that. Most people in the Air Force don't have that capability because, you know, the Chinooks, the aircraft are being maintained and they're still operating, and the actually the input that Chinook has had to the COVID effort is not negligible. There was some work last year on looking at putting you know, medical support equipment in a Chinook and fitting it properly and stuff like that, and how we decontaminate a Chinook that's been carrying COVID patients. But what I do, I can do from home, minus some of the systems that I work on where I need to go into the office and use other computer networks. So we've been setting up a daily call with the avionics team. We would normally all sit around a desk. Well, 10 of us would sit around a set of desks together. Now we all speak for half an hour on the phone, on Skype every morning. sort of just a bit of an alignment piece so that we, that we know everyone's all right. That was definitely the primary thing, certainly when we all started working from home. It was a welfare call as much as anything else, but now it's a, these are the projects that we're working on, these are the issues that we're having, and a little bit of knowledge sharing, which is good.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
Just from an engineering perspective, Kathy, I mean, I know you said you can do most of what you need to from, let's just say, from a remote location. How, I mean, I feel this in my day job. I sort of feel a bit cut off from the culture and the organisation and my colleagues. The military's quite a close-knit unit by its nature. How are you feeling working remotely?
If everyone were back in the office, I would gladly be back in the office. The hive mind in the Chinook team is excellent, and the makeup of my team is 50% civil servant, 50% military. We have a couple of Air Force chiefs who have worked on the platform for quite a long time, who are now in a supporting role in the delivery team. So they are the hub of like practical knowledge of the Chinook within the avionics team. I've got a civil servant boss, John, who knows the entire history of Chinook and its systems, and it's all in his head. So like his knowledge is really good from that perspective. And then so having those three as a resource for the rest of us to like deliver output is really helpful. And I really also feel for people who have joined the team in the last year who've had to do that remotely and have never necessarily met the people on their team and stuff like that. I managed our apprentices through the Defence Equipment and Support Apprenticeship Scheme. And I think it's been a really tough year for them to join a team without any knowledge at all about the aircraft. Some of them have come to me without any knowledge of aviation because they're doing multi-domain apprenticeships. So they've done one rotation in land, one rotation in ships, and then have come to us for their third. So trying to, and the stuff that you would normally learn by osmosis, it has to be very deliberately taught, which is a very different sort of learning style for people, which has been, I think, has been difficult for them. And I do miss like office banter as well. I think we're quite strong on banter in the military, and there's, you know, a handful of us will log on 5 minutes early in the mornings and we'll just chat about things, you know, because it's nice to do that.
And let me ask you then about banter and about being a female then, Kathy, if you don't mind. How have you found it?
It's a really good question. That sounds like a cop-out. As a Jengo on a squadron where I was, you know, managing 242 technicians, of which two were female, that's a big thing, you know. And also that because of the way that we operated, there was a little bit of a you need a little bit of detachment as an officer sometimes, and knowing where that line is can sometimes be very difficult. Because we were in this slightly strange military civilian mix on A400, I think that line was in a different place, and it was easier for us to be a bit more comfortable around each other, which is, I think, as it should be. But I, I lived in America for a few years. When we moved back, we moved to a nice part of Hampshire, and kids can be a bit cruel. So
yeah.
When I turned up with an American accent, it was noticed, you know, and it was commented on. And now, and apparently my defense mechanism is that I have ended up with this very, very English voice and what some people will call a dairy officer accent. And I don't swear, it has pros and cons in the military. But the one time that I did swear in the office, everyone did kind of pay attention. Stuff was going on, and it was a very stressful day.
They knew you were serious.
Like everything went very quiet, and there were about 25 people in the room. When I looked up, there were only four of them left, and they were the four that needed to be there. And everyone else got very busy. So it didn't happen very much. And so that sort of slight detachment of, you know, I remember walking into the line office once, and one of the chiefs said a very rude word, and he was facing away from me. Very, very unfortunate four-letter word.
Yeah.
And everything went quiet. And he just kind of rotated on the spot and spotted me. He's like, "Mom, I'm so sorry." And I was like, "I'm just going to walk out, and I'll walk back in, and we'll start again." Because the line office is their space. Like, it's not, you can't be taking it over or anything like that. It was just a really unfortunate timing thing. So there was an element of that's a detachment when it comes to banter. And in my team now, I think I get not quite labelled as the D&I flag. Sometimes people say something and I'll be like, think about how that came across, maybe.
Yeah.
Is that really what you meant? That was an unfortunate thing to say, wasn't it? And that's fine, because within our team we can have a joke about it and say, oh, you know, that, oh, I didn't quite mean it like that or whatever, and we can have that conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, because banter shouldn't go away. D&I shouldn't take away from us the military culture of banter, because it's been a huge part of who we are. But the ability to say, oh, you know what, I think that one crossed the line, and discuss it, that's really good. And that's, I think, the sign of a really good team, that you can have that conversation and no one feels like they can't speak up if they think that a line potentially has been crossed, or even if you want to discuss whether or not the line has been crossed, you know, like, oh, are we sure about that one? Are we allowed to say that? Which is a thing now, isn't it? That question, am I allowed to say that, is really common.
And that's great. You've got that open style as well, that encourages the discussion, because that's what it really needs to be on some of those borderline things. Because, you know, I've got a mixed background, and sometimes people say things and I think, I don't know whether I should say, am I offended or am I not offended? You know, should
I
be?
Am I meant to be offended? Yeah. Yeah.
Does society today say I should be? Because actually I'm not, you know, and I don't mind. So, yeah, it's really, really interesting. Thank you very much for being so open and honest about that. Let me ask you then, as we sort of go towards the end of our chat, where does Kathy go next? What's next on your career radar?
I would quite like to do a move to Odium next, to RF Odium, and sit in the Continuing Airworthiness Management Organisation. I haven't actually updated that on my JPA profile yet, my work profile, so I do need to do that. But I'm pretty sure my career manager is aware of that being my aspiration, because we have discussed it. So the sort of the trifecta, as it were, of being a squadron junior engineering officer, of working in the delivery team and working in the CAMO is a pretty strong group of job profiles. And I think that my experience on A400 with a really strong CAMO supporting me as a Django means that my perspective on CAMO is a little bit different than a lot of people's in the Air Force. So I think I could do some good stuff at Odium. My partner is in the Navy and is in Portsmouth.
Okay.
So physically relocating to Odium would be really convenient for the pair of us. Yeah. Co-location for an Air Force engineer and a submariner is not easy. So if we can do that, then we will. Yeah.
You two really are both ends of the spectrum, aren't you?
Yeah, very much so.
Exciting discussions. Listen, what does downtime look like then, Kathy?
I'm a keen hockey player. anyone who has spotted me on social media will be pretty aware of that. Air Force hockey has been a part of my life since I was an undergraduate. I was able to play for them when I was a reservist, so that was really awesome for me, because while we were at university, we were encouraged to go and spend a week on a station during the summer, or yeah, you might go on an exercise or something like that. But actually the RAF hockey team, being a huge spread of different ranks, different trades, different backgrounds of people, was probably the best possible insight I could have had to the real Air Force, as opposed to the Air Force that they were trying to teach us about. And the RAF hockey team is like a family. We are really lucky in the people that we have, and the opportunities that we get from that have been exceptional. We spent 2 weeks in Japan a couple of years ago during the RAF centenary year. We got some funding to go on an overseas visit to Japan. The hockey was great fun, but also the cultural stuff. We went to Hiroshima. We visited the Peace Museum. We saw the epicenter of that bomb, which, you know, is a huge piece of aviation history, actually. Yeah. This is the impact, the literal impact of air power in that war. So the woman who showed us around was 8 when the bomb was dropped. And like hearing about that from her side, grown men crying, everyone crying, pretty much. It was really something. And yeah,
you do give back as well, and I want to see if we can give a mention for your centenary walk as well.
The Royal British Legion have their centenary this year. And they are huge supporters of RAF hockey. They are one of our key sponsors. So last year we did a 10K. Every single one of us on the hockey team did a 10K, no matter where we were in the world, from Lossiemouth to Mali. And that was really good for us as a team in a year where we couldn't compete together. Next week, actually, I'm setting off on the Cotswolds Way, doing 100 miles for 100 years of the Royal British Legion, raising a little bit of money, but also just kind of want to be using that as a way to tell people about the history of the Legion and what they do for service people, and talk a little bit about mental health and how, for me, getting outside, getting walking, the concept of a green prescription and the principles behind that is something that I just want to share with people. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to put links in the show notes to that for you. So
that's great. Thank you
really,
so much.
Really, really encourage anyone who can support you, and maybe make however small a donation would be gratefully accepted on behalf of the Royal British Legion. So Kathy, I'll put you on the spot then. What advice and guidance would you give to a youngster, girl or boy, looking for a career in military aerospace engineering?
Two things. One is to make informed decisions. So I was talking earlier about how impressed I am with the questions that I get from young people, and that's a big thing. The people that I've met who have struggled in this line of work probably didn't come to it with a good understanding of what they were getting involved in. And the other is to understand that the thing we say about diversity in the Air Force isn't just lip service, and it isn't just that horrible phrase woke that people are using. It is because it is a thing that we desperately need, because diversity of background and experience brings with it diversity of thought, and that's how we solve problems. So I want the Air Force to be made up of people from all different backgrounds, from all different experiences and all different mentalities. So if you've grown up thinking that you want to do art, engineering is art. And if you've grown up thinking that you are a really technical person, engineering is technology as well. And it's the crossover of the two, and there is a space for everyone.
Wow. That's amazing. Thanks very much for that, Kathy. So for those who don't follow you online, and I do recommend it, where can we find you on the good old internet?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm at Morten Cathy, MORTEN, which is where you'll find stuff about my job, mostly, and about the military. last year, the Air Force asked me to do a takeover of their Instagram. So I've also set up an Instagram account, which is a bit more personal and a bit more photography and stuff like that, which is at Kathy Morton on Instagram.
Oh, I just need to ask you very quickly, Kathy, about photography. I did see you were at Shuttleworth last weekend. How was that?
The air show this weekend was awesome. I've missed air shows so much. I grew up with air shows. Yeah. I really love the format that Shuttleworth did. So their drive-in format, if like me, you are just a little bit of an introvert and find crowds really tiring, the drive-in format is awesome, because when you're done with the people, you could go and sit in your car and have a nap, which you can't do at other air shows and things like that. And I remember finding things like Farnborough and Riyadh just exhausting. Yeah. So. But the content of the air show that Shuttleworth did this weekend was beautiful. It was lovely to see the camel flying, because I hadn't seen it fly since they did their work on it a couple of years ago. And that camel is done in 70 Squadron colours, so there's a little bit of military industry in there that I'm quite attached to. But just a really, really lovely day. And it's lovely to be back at air shows. Air show people are awesome as well.
They are good old av geeks. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been really nice to have a chat.
Really enjoyed it. Well, that's about all we've got time for now. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. And we'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters. Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons license. You can find me on the internet at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Aviation Extended on Twitter and Facebook. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Kathy Morton.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.